Corinthians chapter 4. We've called this series Messy Church because of some of the issues that Paul is dealing with the Corinthian church. 1 Corinthians is a letter to a church with all kinds of problems. It's a messy church, and that means that it's just like every church, because every church is messy, because every church is filled with people, and people are messy. What we've been looking at the past few weeks is that Paul has been dealing with some of the division in this church. The church was filled with jealousy and division and power plays and superiority. People were saying, I'm with Apollos, I'm with Paul, I'm with Peter. And they were aligning themselves with certain leaders and then claiming privilege over other people because of their association. And so Paul has been trying to deconstruct this way of thinking and give them a proper mindset. And now in the passage we're going to look at this morning, Paul deconstructs their mindset by showing them, in contrast, how he thinks, which is so much different than the way that they were thinking. And it's also very different than the way that we often think as well. There's a short book by Tim Keller called The Freedom of Self-Forgetfulness, which is actually based completely on this passage that we're looking at this morning. And that book's been really helpful to us as a team. We've used it in our leadership development. We've given it away to lots of people. We've used it for all incoming elders. And so rather than reinvent the wheel, I ended up using a lot of the material that he uses in that book, which is based on this passage. So I'm just saying that up front so I don't have to like reference him throughout the sermon. If I say anything smart today, most likely it's from the content of that little book, which I would recommend to you. But we're going to be in 1 Corinthians chapter 4, looking at the first six verses. Paul says, "This is how one should regard us as servants of Christ and stewards of the mysteries of God. Moreover, it is required of stewards that they be found faithful. But with me, it is a very small thing that I should be judged by you or by any human court. In fact, I do not even judge myself. For I am not aware of anything against myself, but I'm not thereby acquitted. It is the Lord who judges me. Therefore, do not pronounce judgment before the time before the Lord comes, who will bring to light the things now hidden in darkness and will disclose the purposes of the heart. Then each one will receive his commendation from God. I have applied all these things to myself and Apollos for your benefit, brothers, that you may learn by us not to go beyond what is written, that none of you may be puffed up in favor of one against the other." This is God's word. So Paul here describes his mindset, how he thinks, and he contrasts it with the way that they were thinking. And this is really about our self, how we view ourselves, our relationship with ourselves, our self-talk, our ego. Paul's talking about ego here. Self-esteem is a common way that we talk about this in our culture. We have self-esteem problems, right? But if what Paul is saying is true, then the self-esteem problem that we actually have is different than the one that we might think that we have. If you grew up in America over the last 50 years or so, then you've been told many times about the importance of high self-esteem and how dangerous low self-esteem can be. That the way to become a balanced, healthy, stable, positive person in society is to have high self-esteem, have a high view of yourself. And the thought is that low self-esteem, a low view of yourself, an overly negative view of yourself is one of the main things that leads to bad behavior. It's the root of things like crime or substance abuse or prostitution or murder or rape or all these things. If people only had a higher view of themselves, then we think they wouldn't do these things. Now, the problem with this way of thinking, which is really common in our society, is that it doesn't seem to be true. Our society has some of the highest self-esteem scores, actually. They're as high as they've ever been, right along with an opioid epidemic on the rise. There's a fascinating journal article in the New York Times called The Trouble with Self-Esteem, and the author in that article reviewed some of the latest self-esteem research, which all pointed to this. This is a quote from that article. She says, "People with high self-esteem pose a greater threat to those around them than people with low self-esteem, and feeling bad about yourself is not the cause of our country's biggest, most expensive social problems." That's in the New York Times. And she quotes a social scientist who says this, "The fact is, we've put antisocial men through every self-esteem test we have, and there's no evidence for the old psychodynamic concept that they secretly feel bad about themselves. In fact, these men are racist or violent because they don't feel bad enough about themselves." So we have self-esteem problems, But what the social scientists are telling us is really what Paul is telling us, that our greatest problem is not that we think too little of ourselves and we just need to be built up and affirmed and reminded of how amazing we really are. The problem actually goes deeper than that. Paul describes the real problem with our egos, and only when you recognize the real problem can you do something about it. So let's read that last verse again. We're going to start at the bottom of the passage, and we're going to work our way up. But in verse 6, Paul says that he has applied all these things to himself and Apollos for our benefit. He says that you may learn by us not to go beyond what is written, that none of you may be puffed up in favor of one against the other. So this is the problem that he's identifying. The brokenness in ourselves, in our egos, is that our egos are puffed up. I like how the ESV translates this word, puffed up. This is not the normal word for pride. It's a very unique word. Some of your translations might say proud, but actually the word means to inflate or to blow up or to cause to swell up. And we're just going to think for a few minutes about the implications of that word picture, and we're going to let that word picture that Paul is painting just diagnose us for a minute. First of all, he's saying that we're unnaturally inflated, right? The most obvious part of this picture is that the egos that Paul is talking about, they're puffed up beyond their natural limits, beyond what they should be. And one pastor says of this word, he says it evokes the image of some organ of the human body that is distended because so much air has been pumped into it that it's ready to burst. It's overinflated, it's distended, it's swollen, it's inflamed because it's been extended beyond its proper size, like a bloated stomach that's just aching because it's full of hot air. Have you ever noticed that your body parts don't draw attention to themselves unless something is wrong with them? You don't think about how your stomach feels until you have a stomach ache, right? No one has ever said, ever, man, today, like, I'm just so really happy about how my stomach feels. My stomach feels amazing. Like, no, you just don't think about it at all unless it's hurting. And then you're aware of how it feels when there's something wrong with it, when it's calling attention to itself. You know why your ego is always calling attention to itself? It's because there's something wrong with it. It's been puffed up. Why are we so concerned with how we're treated, with how people view us, with whether or not we're being respected or appreciated or approved or loved or thought of as beautiful or smart or capable? And when we don't feel like we're getting those things, when instead we feel like we're being slighted or rejected, we feel so hurt. Right? Why does it hurt when somebody unfollows us on Instagram? Somebody we don't even know. Why does that hurt us? Well, why does it hurt when somebody blocks us on Facebook or when our posts that we put out there don't get likes or comments? Why does it sting when we hear people talking about us? Or when we don't hear people talking about us that we wish were talking about us? See, our egos are always drawing attention to themselves. Like a bloated stomach, there's a problem. There's an inflammation. And Paul tells us here what is inflaming it, what's inflating it. He says that we're puffed up in favor of one against the other. Okay, so the inflation is by comparison. This is the essence of what Paul is talking about by our egos being puffed up, that we're puffed up with boasting and competitiveness and comparison. Imagine two puffer fish. You know, these fish that they're small when you see them regularly, but they inflate themselves when they approach a threat in order to make themselves look threatening, in order to scare away, you know, fish bad guys or whatever, right? And so just picture this thing where like two of them happen to run into each other, right? And they see each other as a threat. So what do? They both puff up to project strength. But then that's not enough because now they're still the same size, right? So they're each one having to try and puff bigger and bigger and bigger to try to outdo the other. That's sort of like a picture of what Paul is saying here, that the way that we deal with the pain of our hurting, swollen, overlooked egos is by constantly comparing ourselves to other people. C.S. Lewis has an amazing chapter in his great book, Mere Christianity, all about pride. And he says that pride is by its nature fueled by comparison. Look what he says. He says, pride gets no pleasure out of having something, only out of having more of it than the next man. We say that people are proud of being rich or proud of being clever or good looking, but they're not. They're proud of being richer or cleverer or better looking than others. If everyone else became equally rich or equally clever or good looking, there would be nothing to be proud about. It's the comparison that makes you proud, the pleasure of being above the rest. A proud man will take your girl from you, not because he wants her, but just to prove to himself that he's a better man than you. There's so many of the things that we do to make ourselves feel better about ourselves. I think if it would really sober us up if we just took a minute and looked at our behavior and our decisions and asked ourselves how many of these things are fueled not by the joy of doing the thing, but just to feel better than the next man, just to feel better about ourselves. We're building a resume of self-promotion. We do good things to be seen as good. We try to say smart things to be seen as smart. We even do godly things to be seen as godly, so that we can stack up well against other people. Our egos are in this constant struggle. They're calling attention to themselves because they don't feel big enough. They know that they're somehow insufficient. And so we're overcompensating and artificially inflating and projecting strength like a puffer fish, creating this impressive self-esteem resume to fill that sense of inadequacy. But we can only get so big, because the final thing this little word picture tells us is that this puts our egos in a very dangerous and precarious position. We're dangerously inflated, because what happens to something if you just keep puffing it up? What happens to a balloon if you just don't stop blowing up? It's only a matter of time before it pops, before it gets a hole and the air leaks out. If you're inflated, then you're in danger of being deflated. So as we puff ourselves up, we feel pretty good about ourselves when we look around and we're stacking up pretty good against everybody else, right? But we feel terrible about ourselves when things aren't going well and we're not measuring up like we want to. Now, this is the roller coaster of pride and despair that many of us are on. We're filled with hot air trying to make something impressive of ourselves, but it's empty. And when the air gets let out, we're deflated. So being puffed up, having an artificially puffed up ego, is a fragile thing to have. It's a dangerous thing to fill up your self-esteem tank with comparison and boasting, because what we're filling ourselves with isn't really substantial. You can only pop something if it's filled with emptiness. You can't pop a rock, right? You can't pop something that's solid, that's filled with matter, that has substance. You can only be deflated if you've been inflated and puffed up with the empty vanity of boasting and comparison. And so this is the picture that Paul gives us of our egos. It's not a pretty picture. It's puffed up, unnaturally inflated by comparison, resulting in an ego that's always drawing attention to itself and that's on the verge of being deflated. And this is the problem that Paul is seeking to address that's driving their bad behavior. He says, I'm writing this so that you will stop being puffed up in favor of one against the other, because their ego inflation has led to some really bad behavior within the church. And so Paul now contrasts the way that they were acting with the way that he thinks and the way that he's acting, because he's actually found a solution to this. It says in verse 3, but with me, it is a very small thing that I should be judged by you or by any human court. In fact, I do not even judge myself. So the solution that Paul gives to this problem that they have is to get out of the courtroom. Now, what does that mean? What is he talking about? Talking about being judged by a human court. See, what he says here is very interesting. He says, I am not judged by a human court. But as far as we know, nobody's bringing Paul to court here, right? They're not suing Paul. Paul's not been brought to court. He's not in any legal trouble. They were just criticizing Paul. They were judging Paul. They were calling him foolish. They were distancing themselves from Paul. They were saying, oh, Paul's not as good as Apollos, or we know better than him. And they were doing a comparison and jealousy thing. But Paul was not actually in court. But Paul is using a metaphor. He's using courtroom language. And he says, that it's a very small thing that I should be judged by you. This word judge means to interrogate, to cross-examine a witness, to investigate. And so in other words, he's saying it's almost as if these Corinthians had put Paul on the witness stand. He's in the interrogation room with them, and they were judging him. They were investigating him. They were digging up dirt in order to measure him up. And we know that we do this, right? We do this to people. And people do this to us. We take a glance at people and we do a quick little forensic investigation, right? We throw them onto the witness stand of our minds. We measure them up. We decide if they're foolish or wise. We decide if they're rich or poor. We decide if they're attractive or unattractive. We decide if they're worth our time or not worth our time. If there's somebody that we want to be friends with on Facebook, or if we want to unfollow them, right? And Paul says, you've assessed me, you've put me on trial, you've judged me, and you've found me wanting. You've rejected me. Even though I'm the one who planted this church, you've rejected me. Now, those of us who have felt that kind of rejection of people that maybe we were invested in and that we've done a lot for and they've turned their backs on us, we know that that really stings. That can really hurt. That can throw us into a real downward spiral of despair. That's the kind of thing that will deflate an ego really quick. Of course, it can also do the opposite, right? When we get a positive assessment, when we know that somebody's thrown us up on the witness stand and they've assessed us and they've given us two thumbs up, right? And we can tell they are actually really impressed by what they're seeing. I mean, that can drive us to pride when we're receiving a positive verdict from people. We can start to believe our own press, right? See, the affirmation of others can be just as dangerous to the health of our egos as the rejection of others. We can become addicted to the praise of others and live for that affirmation. Live for that positive verdict passed over us by others. And here's the thing. Paul is saying, he's like, I'm not doing what you're doing, but most days, most of us live in the courtroom, seeking to be measured up and to be validated by others. I mean, that feels like exactly what our egos need. We think that if we were just better liked or more popular, we'd be more satisfied. We think that the more wanted we are, the less jealous we would be, the less sad we would be. We think that if we just reached some sort of visible success in whatever, fill in the blank, then we would be content. But it doesn't work. It's a dead end. It doesn't work. And Paul says, I'm not doing it. I'm not buying it. Get me out of your courtroom. I'm not going to play that game. He says, it's a small thing to me that you would judge me. It doesn't hurt me. The cut of your judgment doesn't go deep. It's a small wound. It doesn't get in there into my identity. It doesn't sink me when you pass negative judgment on me. Not only that, but it doesn't swell me up when you pass a positive judgment on me. It's a small thing, one way or another, whatever you think about me. Paul says, I don't get my sense of self and my identity from being compared with others. My self-regard is not tied to your opinion of me. And that resonates with us. We want that for ourselves, right? We say, wow, he's certainly not struggling with low self-esteem here, right? He doesn't care what they think about him. That's amazing. We want that for ourselves to not be so tied to the opinion of others. But the way that we go after that is very different from the way that Paul does here. Because what we usually say is if we say, you know what, I don't care what they think about me. I don't care if they pass judgments about me. We go on to say, what really matters is what I think about myself, right? That's what we do. We say, I don't care what you think about me. I know I'm right. I know I'm in the right. I know I'm okay. I know I'm good. I don't care what you say. And that's what psychiatrists will tell you to do, to have positive self-talk. That's the answer here to low self-esteem, is to stop listening to all those voices about you. You need to listen to your own voice and love yourself. But do you see that that's not what Paul does at all here? He says, not only is it a small thing that you should judge me, he says it's a small thing that you should judge me, but he says, not only that, he says, I don't even judge myself. I'm not just getting out of your courtroom, I'm getting out of my own courtroom. Because it's not just other people that put us on the witness stand and pick us apart, right? We pick ourselves apart. We pick ourselves apart. At least once a day, I do something that I regret, and then I spend the next 10 minutes being sort of distracted, thinking, why did I say that? That was so stupid. Right? It's really bad on Sunday afternoons after I've spent, you know, two services over 30 minutes a pop talking to you guys. There's a lot of material there to pick apart. There's a lot there to feel stupid about. Or there's a lot there to feel overly proud about. Right? When I feel like I'm doing a good job, I can begin to puff myself up. Man, I really crushed that one. We can cut ourselves down or we can boost ourselves up. I read an amazing quote a little while back from that great student of human nature, Madonna. Seriously, she knows herself better than we do. Listen to what she said in an interview a while back in Vogue magazine. She says, "My drive in life comes from the fear of being mediocre. That's always pushing me. I push past one spell of it and discover myself as a special human being, but then I feel I'm still mediocre and uninteresting unless I do something else. Because even though I've become somebody, I still have to prove I'm somebody. My struggle has never ended, and I guess it never will." You hear what she's saying? She's in the courtroom. She knows she's on trial. She's being interrogated. And the verdict needs to be passed. Am I somebody or am I nobody? And she's waiting for that verdict that she's a somebody, but it's never enough. When one comes, you need another one. It's not enough to tell yourself that you're somebody. Our egos can't be satisfied. The verdict that we're looking for, it doesn't come. It doesn't matter what the magazines say or what the fans say or what I say to myself. But Paul defies the courtroom. He says, I'm not in your courtroom, and I'm not in my courtroom either. I don't really care what you think, and you know what? I don't even really care what I think. But look carefully at what Paul says. It's totally different than the way that we think. He says, I don't even judge myself. And then he says in verse 4, for I'm not aware of anything against myself, but I'm not thereby acquitted. He says, my conscience is clear. As far as I know, I'm not in the wrong. Okay, I'm not aware of anything against myself. I'm not currently aware of something that I'm doing wrong to beat myself up over. But that doesn't mean that I'm right. That doesn't justify me or approve me. My opinion of me, one way or another, doesn't actually really matter all that much to my identity. And that's so different from how we think. But we know that that's actually true, that having high self-esteem, that's not enough. I mean, think about it. There are some absolutely horrible people who may have had wonderful opinions of themselves, even as they did horrible things. For all we know, Hitler's conscience was clear. For all we know, he thought that he was in the right. He may have had a wonderful view of himself. He may have had a lot of positive self-talk, even as he did some of the most horrible things in human history. It didn't mean he was innocent. Our own judgment of ourselves could be totally wrong. We can't really trust it. And Paul's saying, I don't live according to my own judgment of myself, good or bad. If I think that I'm messing up, I don't let that deflate my ego and identity. And if I think I'm doing a really bang-up job out there, I don't let that puff up my ego and identity. We have a hard time living that way. The Corinthians certainly were not living that way. Instead, we judge others, and we allow others to judge us, and we judge ourselves. And God help us, we even turn the church into a courtroom just like they did, where the church is the place where we all boast and posture with our spirituality. And when we're doing good, like Madonna, we feel good about ourselves, like a special human being. And when we're doing bad in the eyes of others or in our own eyes, we feel bad about ourselves. But Paul has something totally different going on. He says, you don't judge me, and I don't judge me. You can't inflate me or deflate me. He's off the map. He's out of the courtroom. He's someplace we've never been, and we don't even know how to go to. He doesn't hinge the health of his ego on what you think about him or even on what he thinks about himself. He's not trying to think more of himself like we do in our self-esteem culture. Just think of how amazing you are. He's not dwelling about how great he is in order to boost his self-esteem, but he's also not thinking less of himself. He's not knocking himself down. He's not one of those people that's always down on himself. Instead, here's what he's doing. He's simply thinking of himself less. He's not thinking of himself at all. This is what Tim Keller calls the blessed freedom of self-forgetfulness. And not living in a constant state of boosting your ego up or dragging it down, but getting your eyes off of it altogether. That's true humility. C.S. Lewis says, to even get near humility, even for a moment, is like a drink of cold water to a man in a desert. Do not imagine that if you meet a really humble man, he will be what most people call humble nowadays. He will not be a sort of greasy, smarmy person who's always telling you that, of course, he's a nobody. No, probably all you'll think about him is that he seemed a cheerful, intelligent chap who took a real interest in what you said to him. If you do dislike him, it will be because you feel a little envious of anyone who seems to enjoy life so easily. He will not be thinking about humility. He will not be thinking about himself at all. Wouldn't that be a great way to live? To not be so self-obsessed. To not be worried about how everything you do makes you look. To not be that person sitting around fantasizing about their climb to the top and not just sitting around thinking about hitting big self-esteem home runs, looking better than others, thinking about shining brighter than others. To just not even worry about that. And neither are you always sitting around beating yourself up over things, thinking, oh, I was stupid. Boy, I can't believe I did that. Boy, that was dumb. No. With both high self-esteem and low self-esteem, either way, we're both spending too much time simply esteeming ourselves. It's all about us. To be self-forgetful is to be done with that game entirely, to be done with the obsession of how you're coming across. You want to know what this looks like? Here's a great example of this. Criticism, how you receive criticism is the perfect test of this. Because there's two ways that we usually respond to criticism. Either it devastates us, right? Somebody tells us something critical. You know, somebody criticizes me or the church or the way I preach, and I'm up all night thinking about it. My ego is so hurt and wounded. That's the low self-esteem approach to criticism. You just let it crush you into the ground. Or how do we usually get out of that? We just turn up the arrogance, right? Who cares what they think? Right? Well, who really cares? What do they know? They don't know anything about preaching. They don't know anything about the church. They don't know anything about me. Who cares what the rabble thinks? I'm not going to receive that criticism. I'm not going to let that hurt me. So you can either have the low self-esteem approach and get devastated by criticism, or the overly high self-esteem approach and just don't listen to it, right? You don't learn from it. You just say, I don't care what anybody says. I know I did the right thing. So you have the deflated, despairing response or the proud, inflated response. But what would it look like to be really humble, to be self-forgetful, to take your ego out of the equation? You wouldn't be devastated by it, but you know what you do? You'd actually listen to it. You'd hear it. You'd say, oh, is there some truth in that? I should examine myself to see if that's true. Maybe this is an opportunity to change. Maybe this is an opportunity to grow. Now, that just sounds ridiculous. Who thinks like that, right? Who talks like that? I know I don't most days, but we need this. We all need more of this. We need our egos to be healed, not to be self-hating or self-loving, but to be not so self-obsessed. But this is, as we see here, pretty impossible. Certainly supernatural. The problem is that our egos are sensitive, fragile, and puffed up, and as a result, we're always living in this courtroom, being judged by others and by our own self, and our only hope is to get out of the courtroom altogether. But how can we get out if our egos and our souls are so desperately in need for a verdict to be passed over us, for somebody to approve of us? And we see at the beginning of this passage, look what Paul says. He says, this is how one should regard us, as servants of Christ and stewards of the mysteries of God. Moreover, it's required of stewards that they be found faithful. Faithful to who? To Christ, who we are servants of. So here's the answer. How to get out of the courtroom. The only way out, it's to receive the verdict of the one who matters most. Hey, Paul starts his passage, he reminds us and himself of who he is, of what this life is really about, of what his role was. He says, I'm a servant, I'm a steward. And these are not exalted positions, they're modest positions, but he has an exalted master. He's a servant, but he's a servant of Christ. He's a steward of God. In other words, Paul knew who he was, he knew what his identity was, and he wasn't too impressed all by who he was. He was impressive in light of who he served. In light of who his master was. You don't know what the definition of a successful life is until you really know who you are. If you think that you're your own master, then you've got to please yourself. You've got to live up to your standards. If you're mastered by others, then you've got to live for the approval of others. But when your master is Christ, then success means having your eyes on him and being faithful to him. Paul's eyes were not on himself because they were on Jesus, his master. Now, that sounds constricting to have a master, but it's actually freedom. It's a blessing. Because our main problem is not simply low self-esteem. Our main problem is self-preoccupation. We're empty, and we're insecure, and we're stressed, and we're so tired of the constant comparing because our egos were not made to be so focused on ourselves. Our lives are supposed to be about so much more than ourselves. We were made for him. And our joy would be fuller if we stopped focusing so much on how we are coming across, on ourselves, on our need to be enough. And when we stop focusing on our reputations and we get our eyes instead on the one who is worthy of all fame, guys, it is freedom. It's freedom. And then Paul says something amazing. In verse 4, he says, I'm not aware of anything against myself, but I'm not thereby acquitted. It is the Lord who judges me. So he says, I'm not acquitted, made innocent by my own evaluation of myself. It's the Lord who judges me. In other words, I can't declare myself innocent. I can't pass a verdict on myself. I can't solve the problem of my ego, which is desperately searching for validation. But it is the Lord who can acquit me. This is a judicial term, the passing of a verdict. This is the same Greek word that Paul uses in Romans when he says this in Romans 3:23, for all have sinned and fallen short of the glory of God and are justified. Same word. They are acquitted. They are made innocent. They are made righteous by his grace as a gift through the redemption that is in Christ Jesus. Now, this is monumental. Paul says, we're all in a courtroom, judging one another, judging ourselves. We're all being judged, just like Madonna, waiting for that verdict to be passed. Are we a nobody? Are we mediocre and uninteresting? Or are we a somebody? Are we special? Are we worthy? But Paul says, don't look for your verdict out there. You can't do it, because it'll never come. There'll be some days you feel like you're winning the trial. Some days you feel like you're losing, but the verdict is always out. Then the struggle never ends. You just have to keep puffing yourself up. Madonna said so, and she knows better than us, because she's done more than us, right? She's gone further than us. I don't care how talented you are, Madonna is more talented, okay? She's got more fans, and she says it wasn't enough. It's not enough. The verdict she's looking for hasn't come in yet. Still trying to fill the emptiness of the ego. She's still in the courtroom. But Paul says, not me. The trial's over for me. The ultimate verdict is in, and it doesn't come from other people, it doesn't come from myself, because in the gospel of Jesus Christ, the verdict, justified, made innocent, declared righteous, not guilty, the verdict comes to us, he says in Romans 3:24, by his grace as a gift. As a gift, not because of our striving, not because of our performance, not because we're pretty enough or popular enough or even godly enough, not because of all our efforts to prove ourselves, but only through the redemption that is in Christ Jesus. Every other way of looking at life, every other philosophy, every other religion, it'll keep you in the courtroom. The question is constantly, am I doing enough? Am I being good enough? Am I doing all that I'm supposed to do? Have I met the standard? But not with the gospel. Because Christianity is not do the best you can, go to church, build up your spiritual resume, and hope someday that you find out that you're approved and that God accepts you and vindicates you. No. No, the gospel is that Jesus died to save the guilty, to make us innocent, to make us right with God, to make us his, to give us a new identity in him, and that he approves of us, not on the basis of what we've done, but on the basis of what he did for us. We don't have to puff up ourselves anymore. He fills us up. We don't have to boast. We don't have to compare ourselves with others. We don't have to build a self-esteem resume and try to look good. We can actually stop thinking about ourselves and simply get on with the work for our master. Because with Jesus, we're not working for him for a verdict to be passed on us. If I do enough for Jesus, then he'll pass a verdict on me and approve me. No, we worked from a place of having already been approved in the gospel. The verdict is in. I'm not guilty. I'm declared innocent. Now I can go and get on with my life for Jesus. We can step out of the courtroom. You know why? Do you know why you can step out of the courtroom? You no longer have to let others put you on trial. You no longer have to put yourself on trial. Because Jesus Christ went on trial in our place. Jesus Christ went into the courtroom. The perfect one, the innocent one, the spotless one, the only one who actually was not mediocre, and he was a special somebody. He was God in the flesh. He was worthy, but he was condemned in our place by everybody. The whole world turned their back on him, and he was shamed beyond recognition. He was humiliated beyond belief. He wasn't just unfollowed on Facebook. He was unfollowed by the world. He was utterly rejected as our substitute. He took the trial that you and I deserved so that we don't have to be on trial anymore, that in his rejection, we find acceptance. He looks down on us, and we are sons and daughters of God, and we can now look to God, our master and our father, for the approval and the verdict to the one with the only opinion that matters. How can we worry about being snubbed now? How can we worry about how few people said happy birthday to us on Facebook? How can we care so much about the little slights when the God of the heavens looks down on us and says, through Jesus Christ, to you, here is my beloved child with whom I am well pleased. That's what we have through Jesus Christ. As the band comes up, we come to the communion table. At the communion table, we are reminded that we receive the gift of salvation, of God's approval, of God's vindication, only because of the death of Jesus Christ in our place. So if you're here today and you're not a Christian, you need to hear this. Being a Christian is not about being better than everybody else. It's not about being more moral so that God will accept you. It's about realizing that if it was all on me, it would never be enough, but God came for me. Jesus stood in my place, and my hope is now in him. My hope for justification in this life and the next is in him. It's in him, in his body, which was broken for us, which we remember with the bread, in his blood, which was poured out to forgive us of our sins, which you remember with the cup, so that through him, we would no longer live for others or for ourselves. We live for him who died for us and was raised for us. Now, many of us, we're here and we're Christians, and we believe this, but we've gotten sucked back into the courtroom, right? How silly. How silly for a son or daughter of God to base their self-worth on if they can put up as much in the gym as somebody else, on if they make as much money as somebody else, on if they have as big a boat as somebody else. We get sucked back into the courtroom, puffing ourselves up and being deflated, looking for vindication, but the gospel calls us out of it. Let the gospel call you out of it today. Because of Jesus Christ, if your faith is in him, then the verdict is in. The guilty sentence passed on our perfect Savior so that we can live in the freedom of being justified by God. So let's not go back to that game of boasting. Let's not go back to that game of comparing and puffing ourselves up. Our eyes can come off of ourselves entirely and be fixed on Jesus, our Master and our Savior. So as we come to the table, when we come to the table, we don't come with a small view of ourselves. Oh, I'm so weak, I'm so pathetic, I'm nothing. And we don't come to the table with a big view of ourselves. Oh, man, I've done great this week. No, we come to the table not thinking about ourselves at all. We come to the table with our eyes fixed on Jesus Christ. Let's pray.